Thanks for joining us. I'm Jay Michaels, and I'm here with Mary Elizabeth McCarry.
Hi.
Five Star Arts Journals has been, for more than 10 years now, reviewing and interviewing some of indie theater's most promising names. They range from young and emerging artists first finding their feet in NYC to Broadway producers who take advantage of the rich landscape of talent and visibility that is the theater festival. Now, the Passion Pit interviews are letting these artists speak their minds on life in the theater and maybe a project or two in the works. Look for interviews by authors Susan Merson, Gary Morgenstein, Patrick Hickey, educator, David Sabella, the editor-in-chief of Cabaret Hotspot, I might add, and film producer Connie Hoy, who will be speaking today. She is part of Johnny B. Dunn's upcoming film, Free Range. In future, we'll be talking to Broadway producer Jim Kirsted, as well as theater professionals Doug DeVita, Lori Ray Waugh, Joe Anise, Jake Lippman, Anthony J. Piccioni, Dorian Palumbo, Barnaby Edwards, musician Dan Furman, and author, entrepreneur Christopher M. Struck, improver extraordinaire Nanette Deasy, filmmaker Mark Barron, and the legendary raconteur Richard Skipper, and a host of others. Now, an interesting thing's been happening out there in theaterland. We are entering another realm for women artists. They are finally starting to get the respect they deserve. It seems that women are taking more control of companies and taking a greater position within companies. And we're thrilled that today we have three women that were interviewed. Brittany Church, one of the stars of this 21st century take on Hansel and Gretel, finding them lost in Macy's 2018. We also have Carrie Edel Isaacman and her production of As You Like It. It is part of her theater company that she started called Shakespeare Sports. And Connie Hoy, who just joined the ranks of producer for the upcoming independent film with a screenplay by Johnny B. Dunn, Free Range. It's a story of a group of gay students of a local GSA who take on a major rodeo championship. So we're here to see how these powerful women are holding on to the theater. And now let's hear from Brittany.
This is Brittany.
Brittany Church, this is Jay Michaels. Yeah. If I'm on the line, you're on the air.
Okay, all right. Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm sure like many others. Yesterday I enjoyed some delicious food and fun fellowship with friends. So today's a restful day for me.
I hear you. Right before you begin again on Sunday with Hansel and Gretel, a Christmas Hansel and Gretel. Tell us about the show. You're running now about 3 weeks, I think, and you still have like another four more, and you just added performances.
That's right. We are now having, once December starts, we're going to be having two shows each Sunday, one at 1 p.m. and one at 3 p.m.
Oh, that's great.
So it can kind of get around some schedules with, I know, church and other things on Sundays to get in the way, but now we have two times the chance to see us. The show's been going really well. I have worked with this company before. It's called FACT, short for Friends Always Creating Theater. And I've had a great time so far.
Now, it's updated. This is not the Gingerbread House and all of the other stuff that we all learned as children. What's the new Hansel and Gretel?
So this new Hansel and Gretel, it takes place here in New York City. You'll hear a lot of familiar places being mentioned, like Macy's and Central Park. That's one of the first big changes. The second big change is that it is modern day, so it is in the here and now. And then the third big change is it's a little less scary for the younger kids. There is no witch, there is no oven, and there's no violence of any kind. So it's very family friendly.
No violence. This is the 21st century. What do you mean, no violence?
Not in our show.
Now you guys are in street clothes. Also, you guys, you're not in like little Lieberhosen and things like the original. You're more modernized even in your look.
That's right. Because it takes place in modern day, we are dressed as people you'd see kind of out on the street. You can still recognize people as the characters they're supposed to be, but Yeah, it's a modern take on it.
Do you think the kids attach to it better when they look when they literally look and say, "Hey, that could be me up there"? Do you think they learn a stronger lesson?
I do. You know, I think it's important for you know, every piece of theater nowadays for all different types of people to come in and to be able to look at the actors on stage and relate to them. And I think, you know, for kids it is really neat for them to see people who could be themselves. I know that Jack, our director, had talked to a little girl after one of our shows that we've already done, and he had asked, well, you know, did it look like fun? Do you think maybe one day you'll be up there on stage? And she was like, yeah, you know, I think I could. So I think even in that way, you know, we're having the kids who come to see the show relate and maybe inspiring future actors and actresses, which is always fun.
That's very cool. Now you're also in one of the tiniest theaters, the Manhattan
Oh,
Rep.
yes.
The let's just when I say intimate, that word's in italics and quotes. How does it feel to you, and how do you think it feels to the audience that you're right there, that they're almost part of the action, they're almost standing so close, they're part of the action?
Yes, I have always been a fan of those smaller, more intimate venues. I think it's, especially with our show, it is, you know, it's only an hour long, and there's only, it's a small cast, I believe we're only seven people, and I think it's less intimidating for little kids, first of all, that, you know, it's not such a big space, and you know, you can see really well because, of course, you're very close. I think we've only got three or four rows of seats in this tiny place, and it just feels homey. It feels cozy. You know, you come in off, it's finally getting cold in the city. You come in out of the streets, and you just come into this nice little space, and you can sit and see a show for an hour. It's really nice, and for us, what's really fun is that we can feel a little better and see a little better the reactions that some of the lines get, or you know, how people are enjoying the show, which so far everyone who's come has seemed to really like it.
That's great. That's great. It's sort of like you're telling the story to them. It's almost like truly, you know, like telling them a bedtime story because they're so close. They're virtually sitting on your laps.
Totally.
That's really great. That's really great. Okay, I have a big question for you, and it's so non-children's theater. So here we go.
Okay.
We're in a world now. Let's just say, at last, there is a far stronger feminine presence in the arts and everywhere when you really get down to it. You can find it in so many things now, but in the arts especially. How does it feel for you being a female artist in the 21st century? What's the good? What's the obstacles? What's going on that level for you?
Well, that is a completely different question. I personally have had a pretty great experience being female in the arts in the city. Of course, I think in theater there in the past has been a disproportionate ratio of like male to female parts in a lot of shows. You look back at classic things, but coming from the point of view of an actress, I think that people have noticed that it has come to the attention, and I also think that female directors, female writers, you know, females on the creative side, even female casting agents, have been on the rise. And I think that they noticed that when they were in possibly the acting side of the business or coming up in the business, and have said, this needs to change. And they are doing that. And I think we're on a good trend. I think, you know, sometimes you get auditions and it still is frustrating, but I think we're definitely on an upward trend. And what's really neat is when you do get to be in a cast with a lot of fellow women, and you've all been through kind of the same thing. It's a very competitive field, but sometimes I think when you find the right people in the right cast, they come together and support each other. And I think especially with women, where there can be a tendency sometimes, just because of the small amount of roles or positions available to us, there is a natural sense of competition. But I think the way that we're all looking, and the way that you know, culture and America, I guess, you know, the way that viewpoints are changing, I think it's become a friendlier space. We all have realized that as women, we need to support each other instead of tearing each other down, which has been really neat.
Good for you. Good for you. Well said. Well said. Brittany, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. I'll tell our readers, our listeners, exactly when and where they can go see A Hansel and Gretel Christmas by Jack DeVille in the middle of Manhattan, about these two waifs traveling through the middle of Manhattan. And I want to thank you so much for speaking with us, and I wish you all the best with the show and all the best in all your endeavors. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And
my pleasure. Great. I'll talk to you soon. Ciao.
All right. Bye.
That was a great interview. What? Thank you very much, Brittany, for taking the time to speak to us. So that's about A Hansel and Gretel Christmas, which was by Jack DeVille, which finds the famed brother and sister lost during the holidays in New York City in 2018, and finds out what they think about Macy's. This is every Sunday in November, 4th, the 11th, the 18th, and the 25th at 1 p.m. It's also Sundays in December on the 2nd, the 9th, the 16th at 1 p.m. and 3 at Manhattan Rep Theater, New York City, which is at 17 West 45th Street. You take the elevators up to the third floor. This special production is dedicated to co-founder and producer David Gillam Fuller. Tickets are available at brownpapertickets.com and on TDF off at 9. Hope you come see it. It sounds like it's really a great, great project.
It's hilarious. From what I hear, it's doing really well, and the kids are loving it, and the actors are loving it that the kids are loving it.
Well, that's great. That's wonderful. It's good to have young children have a chance to see live theater. After all, if little children and medium-sized children don't get to see theater, then there is no theater in the future.
Right.
So having these special things done just for kids is very helpful. It teaches them about live actors, about storytelling, about behavior in the theater, how to get to a theater, where the theater might be in their neighborhood or in their city. So it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to have for all kinds of kids, and perfect at the holiday season when children are supercharged and have a lot of energy, a lot of excess energy and excitement.
Oh, for sure.
To have something to do that takes up an hour or so of time and teaches them a moral lesson at the same time. So thank you, Jack DeVille, for creating that for these children. I think that's a wonderful thing. As a mother myself, I think it's wonderful that that kind of stuff is available for children in the city of New York.
Jack's been in the business for 60 years, so he knows how to please an audience.
That's great. So what's next?
Okay, now we're going to hear from Carrie Edel Isaacman and her company, Shakespeare Sports. They're bringing a fascinating new production of As You Like It to New York. It's going to run November 30 through December 8. It's set in the Midwest in 1968. So why don't we hear Carrie tell us all about it?
You just beat me to it.
Oh, wow.
Hello, Carrie Isaacman. If I am on the line, then you are on the air.
Wow.
Welcome to my podcast. Welcome to the interview.
Wow.
Good to speak to you. I haven't spoken to you since we did that film forum 130 years ago.
Yes.
And I'm thrilled to hear that you are supplying me with a fix, as I'm a Shakespeare junkie, and you have a new production of As You Like It going up next week in New York at the historic Players Theater down on McDougal Street. You do what I love. You've taken Shakespeare and you've given it a modern parable. Tell us about your production.
Okay, and by the way, I'm sitting here with my son who's asking for chicken. So just so you know what's going on in the background here. Gonna turn the oven on. The show that goes up.
Well, that's good for our listeners to know. Chicken is on the menu tonight.
Too much information. But I'm thank you so much for inviting me to be part of your podcast. And I thank you for the questions. And I'm also a Shakespeare junkie, and I feel that I could call myself co-directing, because as a director, I definitely collaborate. I have ideas, but then how I'm going about directing is responding to what the actors are giving. And what makes this As You Like It unique as opposed to any other As You Like It that's been produced since, 500 years ago, somewhere between 450 years ago, is the original music. And somehow when I started how I came up with the idea for this production was I thought it was going to be super ultra modern because I really like that. Like, how do we relate to Shakespeare's words today? What does it mean today? And why, after 450 years, what do I have to say today? So I always think ultra modern, but it just kind of I had a light bulb moment where I thought, wow, you know, they're in the forest. And with all of the protesting that's going on, which reminds me of what I've seen in pictures about what protests were like in the late 60s and early 70s, I would really like to set this in the late 60s. And so then I started talking with musicians and composers, and one person who was auditioning for the role of Hyman brought her ukulele. And then when I was auditioning people I was really more about roles. I started asking people if they could sing. And then I started thinking, wow, I really want to do more of the music in this production. And so here we are with having original compositions for all of the music in As You Like It, which as far as I know, isn't done a lot. Usually maybe one or two songs are used and not all of them. I as far as I know, I think there are some productions that go and work on all of the music, but that's been a great joy for me to get to work on. And just being really, you know, conscientious about rights and stuff, I knew it was really important to do that. So as it turns out, the person who is playing Hyman, she wrote the composition for her music and another song. And then I spoke with Donna Stearns, who is a director. She acts as well, and a composer, and she composed the other music for the other songs.
Oh, that's great.
And I really, the cast, I have to say, is enjoyable, and I'm indulging in playing the role of Audrey, which is tons of fun. It's a lot of fun, that role, Audrey.
So you're, it's interesting that you've taken the turbulent 60s, and made it a parable for today in terms of protest, in terms of political upheaval. You're also making a statement about music, because the 1960s music went through a paradigm shift, the likes we have yet to see again. You're sort of by taking the original score, for lack of a better term, from Shakespeare and musicalizing it, then you're making several parables with this, several educational parables. That's great.
Certainly. There were a lot of things that were going on that were changes hand in hand with ideas about changes that needed to be made, and along with those expressions of change was music and many other things. I suppose you could say, well, what other things were affected by the political change, you know? And when a person is, as you're a professor, so you would relate to this, is if you're teaching theater, looking at society and what are the different changes when you're doing research that were going on at that time, and how did one thing affect the other? So yeah, I suppose that the two work together, definitely.
You're also using, I remember you telling me you're using like the method of scrolls or something like
yes.
that?
Yes. Actor cue scrolls. A lot of fun. It's I was introduced to that when I was invited to be part of a company several years ago. And I just thought what the unrehearsed Shakespeare, which many people, when they work on them, they go straight to the how it's developed, is that when you do unrehearsed Shakespeare, there's supposed to be very little rehearsal, only
right.
rehearsal on what Shakespeare's stage directions. But I think I may have shared this with you when I wrote about how I came up with the idea of doing something that's more extended from unrehearsed Shakespeare. Is by the time you really work into the music and all of the things that Shakespeare's saying need to be there, you kind of have a show. So it may be that in the future, I just want to use the scrolls as a rehearsal tool. And I think there is debate about if the scrolls were on stage with the actor, with Shakespeare's men, throughout their rehearsal process and their shows, or if they just use them for rehearsal time. There was very little time during Shakespeare's day to go from rehearsal to show. So they each had their part. And this is kind of bringing that in. It is teaching of history, of what was it like to rehearse in Shakespeare's day. And we're just using that on stage.
That's pretty cool. So essentially, aside from modernizing it, you're also bringing us back to the real way it was done way back when.
It's kind of urban and way back when.
Wow, that's great. So when we walk into your production, we're going to see exactly how Shakespeare and his guys put it together. And then you're going to show us what the 60s have to do with what's going on in the world today. So we get then, now, and even further then. Good for you. Good for you.
I was going to also say draw a connection between the costumes and the Renaissance, which is that thankfully the person who was lending us the costumes said, you know, there really is something that she's lending us the costumes, which are in Arden, which is the when the teenagers, which we've now shifted them to early college, kind of makes a little bit more sense in our modern day.
Especially when playing them as hippies, then yes, definitely.
When the lead characters go and are made to leave, and then those who are their allies are made to leave and go into the Forest of Arden, they are faced with having to survive, and they meet people they never would have met. And so they start, like, Rosalind has to dress up as a boy, and then who is accompanying her is her cousin. So, I wish I had some good examples of what that would have been like in real life, but Shakespeare uses that young girl dressing up as a young man so that she can survive and has to go and survive like Viola and goes into the woods. But all of the characters have the Renaissance costumes that our costumer has and is lending us. And she said, you know, in the 60s, they really did kind of have a connection with Renaissance look. If you look on these album covers, for example, some of the music I looked at when I was researching music from the 60s and what I talked about with the composers, for example, you have people dressed up in Renaissance costumes many times. So there was a connection there.
You're right. There was a start of it. You look at a lot of pictures from the late 60s into the 70s. You see the ruffles and you see flares and you see things that you probably saw during the Renaissance as well.
Yeah. I think Renaissance Fair, I'm not sure when it was started, but I think it was kind of a part of that. I don't know. I think it may have been started in the 60s or something, maybe early 70s.
It looks like it started in the 60s.
Let's put it that way. Does look like that.
Okay, so now I have the big question, and this is the real curveball. I have been noticing lately, and we're going to do this on the podcast also, we're going to have stories about this. There is an obvious shift also in terms of personnel. I'm seeing so many more women taking command of their art, of the shows, of companies, or whatever. And you're a perfect example. You're the artistic director of Shakespeare Sports. Tell me what it's – I'm seeing it from my end, but tell me what it's like to be a female artist in the 21st century. What's the good? What's the obstacles? How do you feel about being a female artist in this century?
How do I approach that? Where do I start with that? The thing that is a reason why I would want. Just a moment. Just Nathan. 1 second. One of the reasons that I would want to be a female artist who is kind of at the helm of leading a group for a something like the art form of theater is that it's a way for me, it's a way for me to get to do the art itself, bottom line. I mean, I wish I could say... as it turns out, thankfully, let me say this, and let me frame it this way. As it turns out, I actually enjoy it, and I started to look at what my strengths were. So, as an individual, and maybe why am I also, in addition to that, directing? Because the last time that we worked together, I was really kind of more focused on acting. And so, why the shift to directing? Also, as you know, speaking from the individual. My own perspective of why the shift in, or maybe this is in addition to your question.
Mm-hmm.
I started looking at my strengths from when I studied theater arts way back in San Francisco, and I got a pretty good, I had a very easily directing in the classwork that I did was a little bit easier for me than I had anticipated when I thought that acting was kind of the first thing that I would want to be doing, since that was the focus. So I'm directing, and as it turns out, I'm enjoying it, and I am getting to combine through this art form the old and the new. So anyway, I think that the challenge might be, and this is a challenge for everyone, is how to raise money. And so I, in addition to that, needed to work on, sustaining my daily life, which is outside of theater. I work with kids, and then from that I can start the foundations for producing. And because of the good experience, although we're going to be opening very soon, I would want to do it again. So
you think now in the 21st century you have more? Would you say you have more opportunity as a woman artist?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, in the 21st century, well, I'd say that these days there is a lot more. Like, I want to do that, when the barriers that I've faced, you know, may have been that if someone just wanted to do something, maybe they couldn't. So there are more opportunities, I suppose.
And more welcoming for women these days?
Yeah, and more like, hey, that's great that you want to. I'd say more to a greater extent these days. Yes.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad those doors are opening for you as well.
I guess it means that. I guess part of it is that I'm enjoying it. I guess that's kind of the whole. That I would think that it's just like, well, if a person likes it, they can do it. But in the past, that any person, if it's just like, are the doors open for them? So
you found there may have been some barriers for you, you know, way back when, or even for our predecessors, if you will, for your predecessors. But now, for you to use your art, for you to say, I'm going to do this, it's a little more open for you.
Yeah, at this day and time, yes.
Cool. Well, may it keep opening, and may you produce all of his canon and have a blast doing it constantly.
That's what I definitely plan to do. There are some plays that would be more difficult for me, like some of the histories, because you know how some people are real history buffs,
mm-hmm.
and I just haven't had a lot of time with that. I really like the idea of working on Henry VI Part 1 if I had to, or Henry IV Part 1, but there are some directors out there who just know the histories really well. I know the comedies really well just because as an actor, that was easier for me. And some of the romances I really like a lot, some of the tragedies I really like a lot. I think for my next steps, I would want to work on plays that I've done as an actor so that I can easily navigate them. And maybe I would bring someone to collaborate with me on history play.
And when you do Richard III, call me. That's a dream role.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Carrie, I want to thank you so much. Oh, my pleasure. I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today. I will tell our listeners exactly when and where and how they can get tickets and where the show is and how great a time they're going to have seeing the production.
Should I say that now, or you're going to say
Don't
it?
Even worry. I'm going to say it later, because I know your son is bugging you to prepare lunch. And so I'm going to let you go do that. And I'll take it from here. Thank you so much for speaking with me, and good luck with the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for including me in your podcast. Talk to you a little later then.
You bet. Ciao.
Great. Bye.
Great. Thank you, Carrie. This is As You Like It, and it's going to be playing in the city of New York from December 30th to December 8th at Downtown's Historic Players
November
Theater.
30th.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I'm much rushing things along. Sorry. November 30th. I keep thinking it's later in the year than it is. November 30th through December 8th, beginning of December, at Downtown's Historic Players Theater. This is a 115 McDougal Street between West 3rd and Bleecker Streets. It's a great theater.
It's a great
stage. We've done shows there. We did actually a Fringe Festival show there some years back. I think maybe two. We did two shows there at the Players Theater.
Yes, we did.
And it's a nice place. And nice people run it. And it's a great, comfortable place to go see a show. And it's kind of a good idea to do something that's not holiday specific during this time of the year, because it gets to be a little too sweet after a while, and one needs to cleanse the palate. And Shakespeare and As You Like It is a perfect way to do that. And it's a great company, a great show.
Shakespeare's comedies are quite intellectual and a lot of fun, and rarely done. Everybody aims for the tragedies. They all go see that Scottish play, or Hamlet, or Richard III. So to go see one of his more lighthearted pieces is still apropos.
Well,
for
Jane
the
and I have done about, I don't know, maybe 20 different Shakespeare productions or maybe more. And we know that it's specifically very hard to do the comedies. Comedies are actually harder than the tragedies in Shakespeare, at least that we've come to know, because they were done in a different style at the time. It's a very sort of slapstick in vaudeville sort of a style, and people at this time don't really understand that kind of comedy, so it's hard to get it done. And this company I hear is doing a fantastic job doing a comedy of Shakespeare's.
As Carrie mentioned, they're doing it in old style as they did in the days of Shakespeare, but they're updating it to the present,
well,
so it becomes
smart.
Very
no, I think
accessible.
It's smart. They're doing it in 1968, which is great.
Yeah.
You know, he was saying, well, there's a homeless Orlando and Rosalind meet up in the woods out of necessity, and hippies and that kind of
the
thing.
The merry band of players becomes hippies.
That's funny,
yes.
Interesting. We just did a production of Lion, which we set in 1968, too. So now that 1968 has become old time.
Was it 68?
Yeah, 1968.
Oh, that's
exactly
great.
We wrote that. We put Lion back where it was written. In 1968, and we used a lot of the same ideas of that opening and new burgeoning time and thought time at the end of the 1960s, how everything started to really change. And
yep.
It's actually starting to be the same again. It's a lot of new openings happening now, spiritual openings and
yep.
ideology openings.
Yep.
So it's interesting that we're putting plays back at that time to revisit that thing.
Yes.
So we're going to reboot of that kind of really open-mindedness and consciousness, and I guess that's what they're pulling upon, too. They must be feeling
sure.
the same thing.
Armistead Maupin in Tales of the City had a line where one of his characters says, I can't find 1967 anywhere. Well, okay, we can't find 1967, but it looks like 1968 is making
well,
it.
That's
up.
A big year. You know, can look that up and see everything that was going on from Vietnam to, you know, all these the protesting and everything starting to change and people starting to really, really take a stand for rights of all sorts across the board. So it's a big time, and we're also doing that now. We're under an oppressive regime in the White House, and we're also now starting to rise up again as a people who aren't comfortable with that kind of regime. Or even if they are, they're still starting to see the cracks and that kind of a thing. So this is a really very timely way to put a play up, and it's specifically, you know, very brave at during the holiday time,
yep,
like I think.
Very
and
much
I
so.
Think very smart to go see something like this during the holiday, so you have a sort of, like I said before, a cleansing of the palate, cleansing of the mind, something different than Santa Claus. Right?
And I give Carrie a lot of credit. She is yet another one of those women warriors that I'm talking about that's taking control and running her own company.
Well, it's about
and
damn time.
Ideas.
It's about damn time.
Well, yeah, actually.
Well, there are actually more women in the theater than there are men, statistically. And there are more women that come to see theater than
yes.
men, statistically. And it's very interesting that women for so many years have been kept out of the stronger areas of the theater and just sort of kept on the side as the either bimbo or mother types on
right.
stage.
Right.
And for years and years, women weren't even allowed, you know, in the past, way past, weren't even allowed to be on the stage at all without being considered prostitutes. So now we've at least come to the place where women have been allowed to be on the stage. Allowed is the word. It shouldn't be allowing. That we are the ones who need to take the theater. It is our art. That's how I feel about it.
Okay.
All right.
I'm all for it.
On to the next. What's next?
Okay, and last but not least, we have Connie Hoy. Connie Hoy is joining the ranks of producer for Johnny B. Dunn's movie for his independent film, Free Range. Now, Free Range has a very interesting plot. Free Range basically is the story of a group of members of a GSA. A GSA is a gay straight alliance, and that's usually a club within schools and community groups. And this group of young people are now bucking the system, literally, and they are competing in one of the largest rodeos. So Connie will tell us all about that, as well as what's happening with it.
All right, here we go.
This is Jay Michaels.
Hey, Jay, how are you?
Nice to meet you. Welcome, welcome to my podcast. Welcome to the interview, and welcome to Free Range. This call is being recorded for quality assurance.
Of course it is.
You've just come on board as producer for Free Range, Johnny B. Dunn's screenplay, and
correct.
And we're now in the process of turning that into a major motion picture. Tell us about yourself. Tell us about your concept of Free Range. We've never met, so I'm sitting here with rapt attention as well.
Gotcha. Well, you know, I've always loved the rodeo, and just being an independent filmmaker, Michael Harkins, who's going to help me produce, brought this to my attention. I grew up in the town of Cheyenne, Wyoming. And I worked for the world's largest outdoor rodeo.
Wow.
At Cheyenne Frontier Days. So I know the appeal of what a rodeo film could mean. You know, it could be what Days of Thunder is to was to stock racing, you know, to really bring rodeo up to the forefront. And, you know, it's used to be the world or the America's number one spectator sport.
Is that
more
right?
More so than professional football, more so than baseball. There are more pro rodeos every weekend across the United States than there are is NFL. Now, this was back in the
wow.
in the early 80s when I was working for Frontier Days, so I know that to be a fact then. But if you think about it, rodeo kind of runs 52 weeks a year.
Yeah.
Or maybe 50, you know. National okay. finals usually takes place right before Christmas, and they start up again in January. So
right.
there's appeal out there, and it's, you know, it puts butts in seats.
I was going to say, now you say an appeal. Universal appeal? Now, I've for me, past episodes of The Lone Ranger, I have never gotten on a horse. I don't know much about it. How am I going right. to enjoy this movie?
Well, I think with the LGBTQ, that whole aspect of this as well, you know, there's always a thrill of being a cowboy. And
mm-hmm.
and not only with the that aspect of it, as well as, you know, being down on your luck kind of guy, that's got a lot of appeal to me as well as a producer.
So we have the story itself is two characters. One is, as you said, you know, it's sort of like reinventing the Marlboro Man on that level. It's this great rodeo
Absolutely.
Hero who is now due to an injury, his life must change, and he
yes.
comes head on with a group of GSA students, Gay Straight Alliance students, who want to be part of this rodeo. Now, I've heard there's like an untapped world to this, that the notion of the gay rodeo is huge.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's growing every year, too.
Wow.
It really is. So that's a whole new branch for rodeo fans to help the attraction for the viewers to come see this film.
So this is
sure.
this is a whole untapped market. It's like we're taking something that's out there that's huge, but it's never been put on film before.
Correct.
That's great.
Correct.
That's great.
I mean, there was a film called 8 Seconds about Lane Frost, but, you know, in that film, you know, everybody, this was a bull rider who died at Frontier Days. So I don't think the rodeo community really showed up for that film because we all knew what happened at the end.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wasn't happy. So
right.
this actually has a really good theme. You know, the aspect of the brothers and just incorporating GSA and, you know, the kind of down and luck old cow, you know, Marlboro Man kind of guy that is very common in the rodeo world, man. Once you're done, and then you don't know what to do with your life.
Hmm.
You know, it was very appealing to me as well.
I'm going to give nothing away. There's no spoiler alert here, but yes, the whole piece is so realistic, is so compelling on that level. It's not formulaic. It's not we don't sit there and roll our eyes at any point. We really get a real sense from these characters, which is exactly how a film should be. Anyone I've interviewed, that's a main thing that they've said. They don't want the glitz so much. They don't want the Hollywood noise. They want something real on this. And everyone I've spoken to comes out to this and they said, wow, that's wonderful. Can't wait to support it. Where are we in the journey? Where are you? I'm sorry.
Well, that's the appeal to me as well. Cause I came up with the likes of the Coen brothers on Raising Arizona, Jim Jarmusch on Mystery Train and Dead
right.
Man. And that whole indie world is what appeals to me the most. There's not going to be too many cooks in the kitchen. You know what I mean?
Right.
Make it a really a true, nice little gritty independent film.
You use my favorite word, independent. I was just speaking to Joey McNeely, who's premiering a new musical in independent theater off Broadway, and he comes from Broadway world, and he was saying how amazed he is at the way you can almost make up your own rules in some cases. Do you find that
yeah,
with
absolutely.
independent film? Do you find that, as much as obviously there's a certain technological need, do you find that your mind, your imagination is the first thing to be able to utilize?
Yeah, and I think you can just, you know, as long as there's some sort of appeal that you truly believe for a viewer, you can pick what you want to do for as a project. The last film I produced was with Allison Eastwood, which was actually released just a year ago, called Battle Creek. And, you know, that's the fun to me of independent filmmaking is, you know, you can kind of do what you want as long as it, yeah, we always say script.
Of course.
And the story. And I believe the story's there for Open Range. So
I've seen, and do you think I've kind of answered this own question by mentioning these movies like My Beautiful Laundrette, The Full Monty. There are so many independent films that are just Slumdog Millionaire. You almost say, wow, who would go see that? And it turns out to be a blockbuster. As much as it's not necessarily an independent film, The Shape of Water, last year's Academy Award winner, you would not imagine that to be an Academy Award winner. Do you think the world is, we've always been open to it, but do you think the world is clamoring for that? Do you think they would rather go see something interesting, odd, from somewhere else, about something else, than the customary? Have we entered the world of where everyone is that inquisitive in terms of films?
I can only speak for myself, but, you know, as much of a comic book lover that I am, I don't know how many more Superman or Spider-Mans I can go see.
There you go.
You know what I mean? Or Robin Hood, even though I'm going to probably go see it. You know, I like the idea of telling small stories. Three Billboards last year just absolutely blew me away. And what an amazing story of a guy driving through a town, seeing these three billboards, finding out what it was about, and making a movie, in which, you know, garnered a lot of great performances. I think the best of last year, too, as well.
You'd think, what you mentioned about comic books, obviously Stan Lee has recently passed away. And,
of course,
When you think about the work he did, when he came into the comic book realm, yes, every character came from another planet. They were infallible, and they all were tremendously white, and that was that. And he himself imbued his characters with these unique problems, these unique thoughts. My favorite, Spider-Man is this dweeby kid from Queens. So
they're all flawed, weren't they?
You know?
And Peter Parker was just a geek, but, you know.
So it really seems to be enticing to find something where you could say, what? A kid from Queens is now a superhuman Spider-Man? Or wait a minute, I'm going to a gay rodeo? What? It's something where the audience will blink and say, no, I need to see that. What's the next process? What's the next thing? Right now we're in screenplay. We're in solicitation mode where we're screaming the name of the film to the world. What's the next thing? What are you working on right now?
Well, I need to see how much we can do it for. That's my specialty is to schedule it and budget it and, you know, kind of just initially call and figure out where we can shoot something like this so we know really what we can do for what we have, and contact the PRCA and reach out to them and you know, maybe some sponsors and get them on board as well too.
We're gathering the troops, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Circle in the wagons is what I would say.
Well put. Well put. Now, here's the big obstacle. In working in independent theater, which I've done for many years, I noticed that if you can't make this amount of money, okay, I could do this. I could do the play for this amount of money. I could do it for this amount of money. Instead, I'll just do a stage reading. I'll do a workshop. You can always go, I hate to say go down, but you can always find another level to do it. You can't do that with film, or am I wrong?
You know, I think you're wrong there in a very unique way, in that look at what the Millers did with the Coen brothers did with Blood Simple, made a trailer and then they went and found the money to make the film. I worked with a twin brothers called the Miller brothers who basically shot a trailer, went and showed it to Ed Harris, and lo and behold, we were shooting the whole film a few months later with Ed. It was called Touching Home. And, you know, that got a great little release. And once again, it was a great, you know, gritty story that about baseball, America's pastime. So I think, you know, get something that appeals, you know, get a good package together. Know that, you know, seasoned pros are going to be attached to this, and confidence is high in them to really just press on and move forward.
So you say, is it a common practice to create the trailer first and then solicit the film?
Not necessarily, but that's certainly another approach you could do.
It's funny you say about Robin Hood. I remember Kevin Costner's Robin Hood of a million and a half years ago. And I remember there was a trailer that didn't include him, or Alan Rickman or a bunch of others. I remember seeing a trailer for Robin Hood in the movie theaters that did not have them. Now, I don't know if it was another movie or something that came out simultaneous, but I remember seeing that. And then I remember seeing the movie without them. So I was like, wow, as you said it now, I just thought, did I just see the trailer that they made in order to make the movie? So that's really interesting. That's really interesting. Do you plan to do that with this film? Or are we looking at a free-range trailer?
Not really. I have, you know, I'm just in the very basic beginnings with Johnny. Uh-huh. I think it's always, you know, appealing to do some sort of sizzle reel, you know.
Cool.
Just to go along with the lookbook, you know.
Right.
So
right.
Something like that.
Cool. All right. So we are looking at some sort of video that we'll see coming out, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, and with, you know, social media, you can really get a buzz going that way.
Oh, my God, yes. Between you and I and all my listeners, I love social media on that level. You can put one sentence out and a million people now know all about it. I think it's on that level, it's brilliant. Then, like any superhero, it falls into enemy hands, and that's the end of that.
Of course.
Tell us something we don't know. Tell us a secret about this movie that we don't know yet. Tell us something that won't be in the press release. Anything where you're saying, oh, my gosh.
I don't really have any. I don't have any secrets. I'm still digging my teeth in and you know, circle back to me in a month or so, and maybe we can give you a little tease about something.
And then there'll be a story or two. Terrific.
Yeah, of course.
Terrific. Connie, thank you so much for letting me listeners know about Free Range. I will, on the program, I'll make sure everyone knows how to contact you or Johnny in terms of interest, and obviously where they can go to find out more information about it. Thank you so much.
Sounds great. Thank you, Jay. Have a good day.
Same to you. Ciao.
Bye.
Thank you, Connie, for that informative interview. Johnny B. Dunn's Free Range right now is looking for backing. It is looking for investors. If you or someone you know is interested, please contact us here at the studio, jmae.events@gmail.com. jmae.events@gmail.com. That's it for this program. Three interviews. Wow, we did good. Mary, any final thoughts?
Nope, just let's keep women in the theater and keep the theater going.
That would be wonderful. And ladies, hire me. Anyway, thank you all very much. That's it for this week. Really appreciate you listening again. And next week, Mary will be chatting with Susan Merson about more women's issues as well as spiritual issues. And there's also a podcast coming up with David Sabella, the founder and editor-in-chief of Cabaret Hotspot, where Mary and I will be discussing with him the burgeoning cabaret scene. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.